Kind of.
Okay.
We're seeing a traveling on.
Uh-oh.
The host to me says, well, we're going to start it now.
Alright.
But in this we're going to sing all the time the song.
Good.
Thank you. hey, you, 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 hey, you,
Dati nogi se ho we ye ho we ye ho we ye ho we ye he ya ho we ye he ya ho we ye he ya ho we ye ho we ye he ya ho we ye he ya ho we ye he ya ho we ye ho we ye
organic illness, which actually produced the psychotic behavior.
Quit it, doesn't know you, shit. Whoa, yeah, whoa, yeah, 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 whoa, yeah, whoa, yeah, 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 whoa, 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 yeah,
event. That is, for example, we have our hard put to it to find cases of general paresis in order to demonstrate to medical students anymore, because with the treatments, early treatments of syphilis, the stages of paresis are just not being reached, so that this disease is rapidly disappearing out of the picture. Similarly, there may be some increase, on the other hand, in the arteriosclerotic diseases, which produce then psychosis because of the increasing aging of the population and increasing numbers of senile psychotic people. So in this area, there's obviously a definite relationship between social change and disease, but we shall not be concerned with the organic psychosis. But these functional psychoses were finally established by Kreplin as falling into two great categories. One of them were categories which had, was a category which had a good prognosis, that if the individual could be tagged with this particular label, the manic depressive label, then the inference was that the individual had a good prognosis, that he would recover after a short period of time, and in general, this was a benign psychosis. On the other hand, there were the people who were nevertheless excited, who might be manic in the earlier French sense, but who nevertheless would come in and go progressively downhill, as my professor of pathology said, and die, and so on. These people who pursued a chronic deteriorating course, as it was called in those days, were called the dementia precox group. So that initially, the diagnosis was made as much upon what signs were associated with a good prognosis and what signs were associated with a bad prognosis, rather than upon the symptom structure itself. That is to say, they had difficulty, for example, in some sort of the excitement where the individual is in quite disorganized behavior and is acting out a great deal of unorganized, apparently unorganized behavior, although every little movement has a meaning all its own, even in the psychosis, symptomatically, it's even now difficult to say that these people are manic or that they are schizophrenic. One can say this in many cases, but there are some cases where it's difficult to say this even now. And the Kreplinian insistence was that you could make a distinction after the individual experienced the destiny of his disease for a little while, and if he got better, then retrospectively, even if you had called this a schizophrenic excitement, you had to change the diagnosis and call it a manic depressive psychosis. On the other hand, if on admission to the hospital, you had made a diagnosis of manic depressive psychosis and the individual didn't get better, but progressively went demented, became more disorganized and unrelated to the people around him, then even if you had made the manic excitement as an initiating diagnosis, you had to change this to schizophrenia, or to dementia precox, which doesn't make any sense. Well, now, along with this attempt at this big grouping, there also went an effort to establish subclassifications. And for the manic depressive group, it doesn't seem to be very important there. There were certain kinds of possibilities because, as you know, one of the things that came out, one of the reasons why this was called the circular folly, was because the same individual might at one time be admitted to a hospital in a state of manic excitement and on the next admission be depressed. And so that the concept of a circularity in this disease, which was idealized to ridiculous proportions by psychiatrists who describe it as a sort of sinusoidal kind of thing where alternatingly you were depressed and then recovered and then went manic and then recovered and then went depressed again, which never happens, was nevertheless put on the books as a real possibility. So the subclassifications there, manic excitement, there was a hypomanic excitement where the individual was pretty manic but still not manic enough to be housed, too disordered for bedlam and yet still not able really to function in society in that in-between state. And then the mixed states of where some of the schizophrenic features seem to be admixed with this manic excitement. But these things don't need to concern us. What I'm saying here is that so far as the manic depressive psychosis is concerned, we only have to think of it as being either a possibility of manic excitement or of a depression. Now, when we come to the dementia precox group, however, we have a different situation. There, because of what had been going on before Kreplin, there had already been specific localized descriptions of various subclassifications of dementia precox. And so Kreplin finally came to the conclusion that he would have to have at least eight of these subclassifications, but finally settled for three, in that he would first establish a dementia precox simple type, where there never seemed to be a real beginning to the psychosis. The individual seemed most of his life to be withdrawn, preoccupied in his own fantasy, not particularly flamboyant in his hallucinations, but simply being sort of silently autistic and withdrawn and without much relationship to the world. And this seemed to be a subtle kind of insidious process that that one could not ever put a definite start to. Now, the next classification that they decided on was the so-called hypophrenic classification, which had been independently described as a disease process by Hecker sometime before. But in hebephrenia, where the etymological tip-off is that this is a kind of silliness, such as hangs on Hebe's cheek, for example, this kind of thing, the individual was noisy, sometimes assaultive, silly, grimacing in behavior, had a delusional system which never organized, seemed to be constantly in the process of undirected thinking, and was again out of relationship and apparently self-involved. So there was a hebephrenic kind. And then another classification which was established was the catatonic type. Here the individual initially might enter the hospital in a very excited state and then pass into a stupor situation where there would be a good deal of difficulties with motility, where the individual might retain fixed postures or might simply lie without moving, speaking, or with only a slight flickering of the eyelids to indicate that the individual was at all in the situation, and that this posturing might be continued over many days, many weeks, and sometimes for years until the individuals who were left untended as they were in some of the early psychiatric hospitals developed contractures of musculature and could not be taken out of their catatonic positions for the rest of their life. One particular man that I remember very well in my early hospital days, I was going to say psychotic days, which of course is a nice parapraxia, had the catatonic posture of remaining with his knees flexed and his head bent over and his forehead touching the floor, lying on his hands. And he finally kept this posture so insistently and so constantly that he could not be straightened out anymore. there where it was really fixed in that posture because the muscles had adapted to that kind of position. Well, this is one phase of catatonia. Much more important phase of catatonia is a situation where the individual feels himself completely at the mercy of some other hallucinatory projected person and is not able to move even one single bit unless he is specifically told to do so. And hence you get the individual maintaining a quite definite situation muscularly and posturally until he hears a voice telling him it's all right to move his head, and then he moves his head. Or the fear is that if he moves any part of himself, this is rather a frequent kind of feeling in catatonia, if he moves any part of himself, something correspondingly catastrophic will happen in the world outside. That one patient that I had, for example, felt that he couldn't move his foot because if he did, the traffic on the boulevard below would stop, which he could see from his window. So he had to be very careful about his own movements because he would interrupt so many things in the world outside. And terrific feelings of the whole world being centered upon him and his movements having a great deal of meaning everywhere in the world. Well, these are some of the symptoms of catatonia. So catatonic behavior was one of these classifications that was established. And then Kreplin saw that there was another kind of people, another diagnostic category, which he wanted to include under dementia precox, but which did not quite fit, because under his present conceptions of diagnosis meaning prognosis, and prognosis being inevitably deteriorating and progressive in dementia precox, he saw that this great group of dementia precox did not necessarily progress to deterioration. On the contrary, that they seemed to stabilize, and they kept quite alert in many respects, and as he was able to evaluate it psychologically, did not get a very far-reaching fundamental disturbance of their psychological functions. And to this group, he gave the name paraphrenia. Now, these are the people that we recognize now as paranoid schizophrenics, where the implications are that these people primarily maintain their relationships to the world on the basis of using other people as a way of expressing hostility, and probably getting a lot of other disguised satisfactions too, but their need to use other people to hate, so to speak, if we can accept the psychodynamic formulation for a moment, keeps them in the world, keeps them very much interested in the world, and so does not give them the same kind of autistic withdrawal and giving up kind of a situation that you see in other schizophrenics. Now, Kreplin felt, therefore, that they were not precox people because they didn't deteriorate. Later on, one of his pupils showed that you, 5 years later, would have to call these people that Kreplin called paraphrenia, you'd have to call them dementia precox, paranoid type. So the four classifications at that time were then established. Well then, as you know, the next phase was to talk about primary and secondary symptoms here, and to talk about the problem involved in schizophrenia particularly as a splitting of the person's psychological functions, a sort of fragmentation of these functions. And that meant, therefore, that you had to postulate some intrinsic psychological functions. I mean, this was like an attempt to get at a basic personality structure of the person, consonant with the psychology of those days, and they were still operating at the end of the 19th century on the thinking, feeling, willing idea of faculty psychology. And so, therefore, the primary processes were considered to be actual intrinsic organic disease affecting primarily the thinking functions, the feeling functions, and the willing functions, which would account, therefore, for the thought disturbances, for the what we now call the undirected autistic thinking, for the dissociation, as they call it, of idea and emotion, because very early they saw the apathy and the lack of emotional responsiveness of the schizophrenic, and sometimes the emotional incongruity of the schizophrenic, where laughter would be accompanied by sad ideation, and sad ideation or a happy ideation would be accompanied by sadness. In other words, this kind of what Stransky, one of the Swiss psychiatrists, called intrapsychic ataxia. Well, the conception there was that this was a primary process, and so too the catatonic symptoms, which were in the sphere of volition, of willing, and of doing, were thought to be primary symptoms due to some lesions involving the use of the will. Now, there were these primary symptoms, and then there were the secondary symptoms, which were a result of the primary pathology. That is to say, if the primary pathology was within the thinking sphere, then the secondary symptoms came in terms of hallucinations, delusions, various responses of the personality, so to speak, to its own disease. And so, therefore, the idea of primary and secondary symptoms came into the picture and still persists in the present time in the form of how much of the schizophrenic psychosis, for example, and schizophrenia is the name that Bleuler gave the thing, how much is biogenic or ganogenic and how much is psychogenic. Now this poses us then really our first problem in the discussion of the relationship between culture and psychosis. That if we are dealing in psychosis with a real intrinsic disease, with a pathology of the physiological person somehow, then we are by no means hampered in our cultural social investigations. It only means that we have to consider them in a little different light. That is to say, to consider that we have a schizophrenic ready person, and then to assess the interpersonal and social and cultural transactions which either then allow the schizophrenia actually to express itself in the genetic sense as a full-blown disease, or whether it can remain latent and never get really called a psychotic behavior. So that this is the problem in B, which I think one has to, with which one has to approach almost all of the psychotic expressions. For example, particularly is this so, it would seem to me, and very nicely demonstrable in terms of what we may talk about later when we consider depression and suicide. So that even if we can demonstrate the genetic basis of schizophrenia, to show that somehow there is some kind of genetic determination which, as it expresses itself, makes handicaps the individual from birth on in terms of interpersonal transactions, even if we can show this, still we are not absolved from the psychodynamic problem of explaining how the individual elaborates his destiny anyway, with this, however, genetic determination in mind. Now, just as an illustration of how cogent the evidence is here, you see there is no way really of assessing this directly. Schizophrenia particularly has been studied from every possible physiological and biochemical point of view that is turned up, because on the one hand, this makes for very nice, easy research. A new biochemical technique is developed, like the response to ACTH, where you can see the fall in the leukocytes very nicely after an injection of, let us say, 10 or 15 milligrams of the adrenocortical stimulating hormone from the pituitary. And so immediately this is a nice technique. Then you can go and apply this to schizophrenics and see how they react. So the result has been that throughout the last 100 years of psychiatry, we have studied schizophrenia from every possible biochemical, physiological point of view. And the result of all of those studies has been negligible in the sense of demonstrating any kind of physiopathology in the schizophrenic, in the sense in which other physiopathology is demonstrated for other disease. All that has been demonstrated is that, and this seems to be quite certain out of all of these studies, if we run a universal through them, is that the individual who has been schizophrenic for some time generally has a hypofunctioning of all of his biochemical, physiological systems. That is to say, this, however, must be chronic schizophrenia. It's as if, again, the whole concept of adapting with withdrawal, so to speak, and diminution of function is also reflected in the biochemical and physiological area. And so this certainly has been quite clear, that there is a hypofunctioning in chronic schizophrenia. Now, the acute schizophrenias do not show this. They behave on all of these biochemical, physiological tests very much like normal individuals. But after the disease is chronic and the adaptation, so to speak, is established on what seems to be a lesser level of demand, then the physiology and the biochemistry seem to reflect this. Now, we have other kinds of evidence for this, incidentally. For example, there have been some nice studies, particularly since the psychosomatic era has been ushered in, comparing the psychosomatic diseases of people in mental hospitals with the general community and population. And what has been found there is that the psychiatric community, and particularly the schizophrenics, have much less allergic reactions, for example, than the normal community. There's about 17 times as much arthritis, for example, in the general community as there is in the psychiatric hospital. There's 3 times more peptic ulcer. There's about 13 times more asthma, urticaria, and migraine. And this is also true for coronary thrombosis and hypertension. So that, you see, a psychiatric hospital is a pretty safe place to be in terms of one's psychosomatic possibilities and destiny. Again, this leads support to the idea that the schizophrenic just adapts to a stress from the outside by a lower intensity reaction in every sphere. Well, now, If we look just briefly at some of the evidence that about the genetic determination of the of particular schizophrenia, and I'm concentrating mostly on schizophrenia because, as you know, schizophrenia, as it accumulates in the psychiatric hospital, becomes by far the most important psychiatric disease, because schizophrenics live for a long time, and they only about 20 to 30% of them recover. And so, therefore, we're always accumulating a number of chronic schizophrenics in our psychiatric population. So I'm speaking mostly about schizophrenia as a model here for the psychosis. Now, if we look at some of this genetic evidence, then we have studies which have been based upon consideration of twins, both dizygotic and monozygotic twins. And we know that the expectancy of the normal population for the development of schizophrenia is less than 1%. Which, of course, is a very, really low percentage. Now, if we look at the family clustering situation, and of course you understand here that there's no question on the factual point of view that we can see schizophrenia clustering in families. Now, this, of course, in itself is not an underwriting of the genetic possibility, because it may be that there are schizophreniform or schizophrenogenic families, in the same way that we speak about schizophrenogenic mothers. But nevertheless, if disease does cluster in family groups, then at least the genetic possibility is raised. And if, therefore, we can, by using the twin method, demonstrate the high coincidence of schizophrenia in twins, then there is added possibility to the fact that we are maybe dealing with genetic determination. Now, here on this side of the board, I have just put down the figures which Coleman has evolved over a period of several years of study for the incidence of schizophrenia depending upon the family relationship. You see, if you have step siblings, then it's really very low. There's a possibility if one sibling, if one person is schizophrenic, if the step siblings will be schizophrenic, is very low. Or put it the other way, actually, if one step sibling has schizophrenia, the possibility that the individual we are considering will be schizophrenic is 1.8, which is a little higher than the normal population, although the expectancy ranges there up as high as 3% in various studies. Now, when we move up here, what's that?
That's percent, 1.8%.
Yes, that's right. Now, if we move up here to the parents, if one of the parents is schizophrenic, then the possibilities of the child being schizophrenic is about 9.2%. When you move up to full siblings, the expectancy of schizophrenia is 14%. For dizygotic twins, again, as you might expect, it shouldn't be much different than for full siblings, because they have nothing in common except their environment. The possibility here is 14.7. And when you get to the monozygotic twins, then you find a startling figure of 85%, or really 86% predictive possibility, that if one monozygotic twin is schizophrenic, there is an 85% possibility that the other twin will also be schizophrenic. Now, if these monozygotic twins, and Coleman in his study has about 463 pair of monozygotic twins that he has studied, if you consider the range, suppose that we take these monozygotic twins apart at birth and rear them in separate environment, then even in that situation, the concordance possibility is 71%. So that even rearing the twins apart in a different environment entirely from birth onward does not too much reduce this expectancy here in terms of the predictive possibility of schizophrenia. Now, this is a fairly substantiated, well-substantiated study. There are some statistical questions that one can ask here in terms of criticism of this. But in general, this is really carping with the issue. What this really demonstrates is that if you have a monozygotic setup, then you have a very high possibility of both people becoming schizophrenic sometime during their life. And it's also much higher than normal with dizygotic twins and with full siblings. Now, Slater has attempted to do this same kind of thing for manic depressive, but with much looser techniques than Coleman has used. He comes up with something like 11 or 12% possibility here if the parents are manic depressive that the child may also be. And I am not too happy with Slater's way of doing this, so therefore I only put it out here as a possibility and something for which research certainly needs further to be done. Of course, one of the great difficulties, you know, is establishing the diagnosis of a manic depressive psychosis. Because we know that in about anywhere from 60 to 80% of the cases of manic depressive psychosis, the individual may have only one attack during his whole lifetime. That is to say, it might be an early attack as a 20 years old when he has a manic episode for 3 or 4 months, and then he may get over this attack and go for the rest of his life without any real open psychopathology. Moreover, when you're trying to assess depressions, it's much easier to handle a depression by yourself outside of a hospital than it is, for example, to handle a schizophrenic episode. And so, therefore, the attack on the nicety and the fitness of diagnostic terms is not true for manic depressive psychosis as it is for the schizophrenics. Well, now, having said this much on the biological and genetic side, then I'd like next to proceed in considering schizophrenia in terms of what we might call the ecology of schizophrenia. And that, I think, is necessary before one can talk about the socialization of the person and its contribution to the schizophrenic psychosis. Now, I may say that in terms, again, of these subdivisions, obviously these subdivisions, these subclassifications, which the 19th century and the early 20th century psychiatrists proposed as being real disease entities for schizophrenia, have not been borne out, because we know that an individual may enter a psychiatric hospital in a catatonic state and after a time abandon the catatonia and become paranoid. Or he may go from catatonia into something that looks like a hebephrenic kind of situation, particularly if he gets into a state hospital where not much attention is paid to him and where he is allowed to withdraw from the interaction with people and to become progressively more self-concerned. Because after all, there's a certain kind of learning that goes on in the hospital situation itself, which contributes to the disease. And so we know that these maneuvers, so to speak, which are called forth in the schizophrenic person, may at one time give him a particularly catatonic picture, at another time a particularly paranoid picture, and another time he may look like a hebephrenic. So that if he, for example, would be hospitalized in Connecticut this month, and recover after a certain number of times and be hospitalized 2 years later in New York, the same person might have an entirely different diagnosis. As a matter of fact, they might even diagnose a manic depression in some other situation, you see. So that this is one of the great difficulties that one has anyway in the whole pursuit of the relationship between culture and psychosis. Because if one is really going to make a cross-cultural comparison, then at least something ought to be stable. I mean, we ought to have at least one unvarying variable, so to speak. But actually, in the field of psychosis, we are not very close to this. And moreover, when you think about the psychiatric situation in many of the cultures that one would like to know something about, for example, there's Pakistan and India, with its 350 million people, and its 60 psychiatrists. Or there is China, which is even worse, with its 450 million people and only 10 psychiatrists in the whole country. So this means, of course, 10 psychiatrists by Western standards, and which is not the same. The culture itself certainly has something to do about its own definition of a psychiatrist. But this is the situation, however, that happens. Now, many times, incidentally, you can get some idea, however, about frequency distribution of psychosis by looking at what the culture's own classification of psychiatric disease is. For example, in Brazil, one of the famous Brazilian psychiatrists, Rasu, had to reject the crepidinian diagnoses, that is, not reject them, but to add one of his own, which was a chronic delusionary psychosis, which covered very much what one finds very frequently in Brazil, where the individuals have a delusional system. In other words, they are like, in schizophrenia, they are like as if they were in a permanent candomblé ceremony. That is to say, they behave as if they are communicating with the gods and are being ridden by a god and act out this kind of thing. It is not schizophrenia in our sense, because the thinking is not disorganized. They relate to people, but they still have a delusional system according to our standards, and Rasu had to coin a specific diagnosis for this. Well, now, this kind of clue means something. It means that there was recognition that the kinds of expression of schizophrenia in that particular culture could not be covered adequately by concepts evolved from a description of German culture. So this, I think, is significant. But unfortunately, we don't always have psychiatrists with enough perspicacity to do this, so that we are presented with, let us say, the diagnosis which is indigenous to this particular culture. Well, so then if we think, therefore, about these subclassifications as not having very much meaning for us, because in terms, let us say, of what particular culture produces what particular subclassification. I don't think that we can even approach this kind of problem yet. Because this has changed so much in our own lifetime. For example, around 1915, the frequency of these three subclassifications was felt to be in this order, that hebephrenics were first, that you had more hebephrenic schizophrenics than you had anything else, that catatonics were second, and that paranoids were last in the order of frequency. Now we have simply reversed that. We have paranoids first, catatonics second, and hebephrenics third. And this has been due somewhat now to the milieu of the hospital, where we have reduced, for example, the number of hebephrenics by our total push method of therapy, where we attempt to force interaction and not allow the patient simply to complete his withdrawal, and where catatonia particularly is more difficult. As a matter of fact, if one wants to have a neat index of the efficiency of the psychiatric hospital, I've often said, well, one should use the catatonic index. That is to say, the greater number of catatonics, the poorer the hospital is managed. Because catatonia represents, in a chronic state, ultimate withdrawal, as we would think about it. And if you do not allow these people to withdraw, then they have to abandon their catatonia and become at least good hebephrenics. Well, this situation. Well, now about ecology. Now, as you know, the whole subject of ecology has a long history. That is, in terms of just impressionistic ideas about the meaning of the physical and social environment in terms of incidence, prevalence of disease, in this particular of psychiatric disease. But the study that we really look to as being the first study that was really complete and inclusive was the Ferris-Denham study, which was done in Chicago, which attempted to assess the incidence of schizophrenia in terms of the social areas of the city. And results seem to indicate that schizophrenias as a group, because I think we have to call them that, were highest in the center of the city, in the slum areas, and in general followed actually the sharp pattern of delinquency, really, and that as one moved out toward the periphery into the suburbs, the incidence of schizophrenia declined. Now, for the manic depressive population, they found no such pattern. The manic depressives seemed to be scattered throughout the area sites. So that it seemed to be that schizophrenia was associated with poverty, mobility, and with the socioeconomic status generally. Now that brought up the question. We know, as a matter of fact, from other studies, such as, for example, the studies that were done by Lemkow and his co-workers in the Eastern Health District of Baltimore, which were nearly not too good, we know again that there is a correlation between incidence of schizophrenia and the low-class sociological structure. And the question that has to be asked there, of course, is that does the schizophrenia originate there or does it finally get there? And this question has not been solved to any great extent. What we do know is that the newcomers in a community, again, this was the Eastern Health District study, seem to have a greater incidence of schizophrenia than the older families who have been there. So that this may have something to do with the whole problem with acculturation, because as you know, at the end of the 19th century, several papers appeared, particularly out of New England here, and particularly from the Boston area, which showed that the foreign-born were admitted to the psychiatric hospital two or three times as great a number as the native-born. Now, when due allowance was made for the fact that at this time there's a good deal of propaganda for immigration laws, and incidentally, this was repeated again just recently in France, that the French psychiatrists of the contemporary period are very much concerned about the number of psychiatric disorders which occur in refugee people. And in one of the last issues of the Annales Medicales Psychologiques, there was an article which said we ought to have some laws which keep these people out. So that this might have been value bias research. But when all was said and done and shaken down, it appears as if now that you can expect about 20% greater incidence of schizophrenia and of mental disease generally, committable mental disease, in foreign-born population than you can in a native-born population. Now, one of the very famous Norwegian psychiatrists, Ødegaard, was given some money by the Rockefeller Foundation to study this problem. And he came to Minnesota, where there were a lot of Norwegians living, and made a study of the incidence of psychosis in Norwegians over the Norwegians who were non-migratory and stayed in Norway, and the Minnesotans who were native-born. And he found that in each situation, the migratory Norwegians had higher rates of mental disease than the native-born Minnesotans or than the Norwegians who stayed in the home country. So that again, there seemed to be insistence that there was increasing mental disorder in the people who go to other cultures. Now, incidentally, this has also been a study that Carruthers has made about the Bantus, where he has been able to show, and I think rather convincingly, because he has the population figures and incidence per population, that the expected incidence of psychosis in the Bantus in the native establishment is 3.4 per 100,000 of population. And that if these people, this incidentally is compared with 161 per 100,000 for Negro admissions in Massachusetts in the present, at the present time in our country. However, for those people who are detribalized, the incidence of mental disease is 18.2 per 100,000 Bantu. So that you can see the great difference between 3.4 in the homeland and 8.2 in the detribalized migratory people. Now, of course, this doesn't mean, all we know is that these facts may point to a real difference. What that means is still quite agitable, you see, because there are problems of case finding and so on, and cultural definition of what is psychotic and all of that sort of thing entered in. But at least here is this kind of difference. Well then, so the Norwegian study also seemed to indicate this, and if we look briefly at the statistics for Negroes, here again, we are struck with the overall fact in this country that there are more Negroes who suffer mental diseases per 100,000 of population than whites, no matter whether it's north or south. So that the Negro is much more heavily penalized in this particular society, north or south, in terms of the incidence and commitment to a mental hospital. Moreover, if you look at the rural-urban distribution, for example, here again you see something that's quite interesting in that the first admissions from rural areas in this country at the present time constitute about 41 per 100,000 of population. From the city, it's about 80 or just double. Now, somebody back there had a question. No, I mean in terms of the source from which the admission comes. That is, these are in terms of the origination of the patient. Well, you could have a... What do you mean? I'm not quite clear.
What I mean is I can't see why you're assuming that upper north
is less in color than the south. No. I'm only saying that there's obviously a cultural difference between south and north, and that in spite of this cultural difference, more Negroes than whites come from each area, you see. That's all. I'm not saying anything about what the implications are yet. Yeah, well, these are statistics for 1939-1941. The difference in incidence.
Yeah,
the incidence is lower for the south and for the north. Well, there's a considerable difference. I mean, these are in terms of, you see, I haven't applied any statistics to know whether these differences are critical. I only say that if you have twice the difference, you can say without the application of the chi-square that probably this is significant. Some of these other differences I'm not prepared to stand on, see? Yes. Yes. Because, of course, it's primarily rural again, you see, as against the urbanization. So these are factors which have to be corrected. I mean, I'm not making any, the whole situation is too complex to make very much of an explanation of what these figures mean. I only want to throw them out. Yes, I'm speaking of commitment. That's the only way you can expect it. Search. You have to know what facts can be discriminated, and then you can begin to make hypotheses about further following up. Well, so... you into thinking, well, this is a nice hypothesis. And I think this is exactly the spirit in which you have to read it, and not with animosity or hostility, but say, all right, now let's see what we can do from here on to get on with this.
Well, I haven't.
Yes.
I may speak on that. I haven't had an opportunity to go over quite a few of Devereaux's original notes.
Mm-hmm.
And at several points, I found that his material, as written up, directly contradicted
yeah.
The information that he had gotten initially. This had come in, I think, quite unconsciously in developing some psychoanalytic thesis.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the rite de passage, puberty ceremonies, and so forth, I think that you can say that there's one fairly constant correlation. That is, the greater the shift in behavior that comes at adolescence, comes between the adolescent or the child and the adult, the change in role, greater the change in role, the more likely this is to be ceremonially commemorated.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the more elaborate the ceremony is likely to be relative to the general pattern of ceremonialism of the people. You see, this is the joker, because there are some societies which have a tendency to ceremonialize very highly, ceremonialize practically everything, while there are other societies who which play the ritual aspects down, but as a relative matter for each society.
Yeah.
I think that I would interpret this much more in terms of role, alteration, and preparation for new roles than I would in terms of expression, etc.
Yes, that was the thesis that I was pursuing, that really there are positive things in it, that as even if one wants to think of it purely anatomically, and even though the penis is circumcised, that still the effect of this is to change it actually from a masturbatory to a copulatory organ and to enforce masculinity. Otherwise, it would be very difficult to explain why a damaged penis becomes much more masculine than it was before, which is certainly the implication of this of the puberty ceremony. Now, of course,
of course, the puberty ceremony by no means always includes circumcision.
Yes, quite so.
In many societies, does not.
But you have a parallel in some of these things, then, too, perhaps, with the puberty ceremonies for women and the clitoridectomy and so on, where again, of course, there are many ways of explaining this as to why there is extirpation of the clitoris. This could be interpreted again as another castration of the girl, but it could be interpreted, it seems to me, in the same way as taking away the masturbatory organ and emphasizing again now mature sexuality. So that I think, again, that's on the anatomical basis only confirming the new role, in this sense. Yes?
Well, that partially answers the question I had, but I wondered in society where they had puberty ceremonies, if you would just say that they are present where there is a great deal of role conflict, or as you said, if they allay anxiety for people going through them, you would find that there's less anxiety over assuming the masculine role in society where they have.
There's also, they also have a function, of course, in permitting the expression of hostility by the older males toward the rising generation, which certainly is important in some ways, whether the initiation rites are highly sadistic.
Well, you expect from that, say in Australia where they are highly sadistic, you find that a boy would have less difficulty, less conflict over assuming a masculine role. Is that true?
Well, I don't know. That depends on how much opportunity is given him to express his hostility. For example, there is a description of the, I think it's the Kikuyu, or is it? It's an African tribe.
Kikuyu?
Or Maasai. No, Kikuyu. Kikuyu,
yes.
Yeah. And back in 1911 or 1912, when this observation was written, the practice there was that after circumcision, there was a good deal of real sadistic hostility they were really severe ceremonies. Then the young man was allowed to rape one of the old women in the tribe and murder her afterwards. Now, the idea being that they explained it, according to this anthropologist, on the basis that the first intercourse means that one or other has to die. So obviously it's better to be practical about it and kill someone who is already moribund. But the idea also being that there's a tremendous discharge of hostility allowed there, you see, around this. Now this could be interpreted as displacement from the elders to the old lady who was then killed, or it could be interpreted as hostility against the female figure and so on. But at least there is one society where hostility is allowed in addition to the actual suppression. Now, of course, this whole idea of the blood covenant that is made a good deal of in terms of this same kind of thing for the affiliation with the man, with the elders, is and the ancestral elders as well, is enforced, might also have some meaning in it of handling the hostility, you see, that because this kind of blood covenant relationship is much more sacred, for example, than mere sibling relationship. And this might also be another insurance against the expression of aggression.
Well, the blood brotherhood rather puzzles me, because this is always, practically always, between individuals of the same sex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
yeah, but
then
but
become social equivalents.
Yeah, but the aggression between them—that is, if there were, if there was age difference, that that might, however, be a way of handling hostility. Yeah, there isn't.
That is, no.
Oh,
in most of your blood exchange rituals,
mm-hmm.
They are individuals of the
same
sex, and in general the same age group.
Oh, yeah.
But very definitely not with no kin ties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well then this wouldn't fit so well.
Yeah. I'd like to know what the source of this Kikuyu reference of yours.
I can find it.
I doubt the authenticity
of
that very much. For one thing, I don't think there would have been enough old women to go wrong.
Well, there must have been.
Actual
I think it was actually by some religionist. It was actually by some religionist. Probably.
It sounds like a missionary
statement. Yeah.
I always thought it would be fun to take pornography in different cultures.
Oh, yes. Well, the sexual humor also.
There's a little notion which I don't know how generally intuitive, but it's nice in these two or three instances. The Japanese pornography that was seen from Japan tends to traditionally as a sort of institutionalized thing. The penis is always represented as big as his forearm. The whole focus of the picture is on the genital organs. The background is just sketched in with lines. Whereas some of the Chinese pornography that I've seen, there's loving detail taken with all of the background, and the erotic scene and the genital organs generally are more nearly life-size.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to a Greek professor friend of mine in Chicago, and he said that in the history of Greece, while you always had these fertility symbols in the front of each house, which is a penis, that at the time that the position of women in Greek society became, they were subordinated more to men, all of a sudden, at this time, you get the size of these household symbols going up tremendously, becoming much larger. Well, now women in Japanese society are in social organization assume a much more subordinate and suppressed role in relationship to men than they did, relatively speaking, in
mm-hmm.
Chinese society. And I just like this notion that wherever you have a society which subordinates women greatly, then you have anxiety created over the subordination, and if you have this over enhancement of the male symbol.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a tremendous amount of material collected on pornography, which for cultural reasons is why I've never
mm-hmm.
written on it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
he had the whole library full of it, where I thought, and all the Chica archaeological, tremendous amount of collected in the
library. Well, it's confusing me that in this particular culture, the time is right.
I don't know.